Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Founding Fathers view the intersection of science, faith, and politics? Contemporary leaders often struggle with where the boundaries lie between these three disciplines. But for America's revolutionary generation, it seemed not only natural but essential for educated citizens to engage meaningfully in all three. Such is the story of Joseph Priestley, a scientist, political philosopher, and theologian exiled from England for his rejection of the divinity of Christ, who took up residence in the fledgling United States. Author Stephen Johnson tells Priestley's remarkable story in his new book, The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris. Great to be here.
You call Priestley the Zelig of early American history. Can you talk about that?
Well, he has this uncanny knack for appearing in all these kind of crucial moments. In some ways, he's been kind of a footnote in most accounts of that period, at least from the American side. And yet, when you look at his life, he's just there, again and again at all these kind of turning points. And so, that was one of the big things I wanted to develop in this book is to almost kind of see him as this kind of lost founding father who had this disproportionate impact, even though he was British by birth.
He had a lot of interests that he followed intensely, and his first sort of scientific love was electricity. Will you set the stage for us and talk about what made electricity such a captivating thing for the educated classes of the 18th century?
Well, you had this unique overlap with electricity at that point in the sense that you had both a new scientific field that was really being discovered for the first time. I mean, it was a fundamental kind of force in nature that was being understood scientifically, empirically for the first time, led largely by Benjamin Franklin, as every American school kid knows. And so you had, a major conceptual breakthrough in understanding the world. And yet at the same time, you had these incredible gadgets that happened that kind of erupted at the same time. And so you had these electricity machines that could basically generate kind of static electricity, and you could do all these kind of amazing things in your living room with these machines. And there are all sorts of kind of crazy parlor tricks that people would do by kind of charging up electricity and having somebody touch a glowing orb and their hair would stand on end and things like that. There's a diagram in the book of a couple of little kids kind of touching this little electrical machine. And so it was just an interesting confluence of breakthrough science and cool gadgets that every kind of scientifically interested person in that period was kind of drawn into that orbit, and Priestley was one of them.
As a young man, he was a stammerer. Did that have a big impact on his personality?
Well, it's a good question. We don't really know. He wrote about it. He talked about kind of overcoming it, and he became a very successful preacher and minister. And so there was certainly a sense of trying to overcome something and succeeding on some level and overcoming it. And that's in part a story of his early life. He was born into a dissenting religious family in England at a time where it was very hard to, you couldn't go to the proper schools, and there was a lot of prejudice against folks who were not in the Church of England. And so there's kind of a theme of, in a sense, being on the outside that's there in his early life that seems to have ultimately shaped his adult views on the world.
He was also a teacher. Was he good with students?
Yeah, we think so. And he had this great aptitude, particularly in teaching science at a point where science was not necessarily traditionally taught. Because he had these little contraptions, he would kind of bring them in and show the kids an air pump and an electricity machine and things like that. And so it must have been pretty exciting when kids were used to just doing kind of rote Latin memorization and things like that. And he was a great champion as an educator and then later as a writer for in a sense, a much more kind of future-oriented kind of education, or at least present-day-oriented education. One of the first things he ever wrote was a scholarly study of the linguistics of English. And almost all linguistic scholarship had been looking at dead languages or ancient languages up until that point. And Priestley thought, well, geez, we're all speaking English. We should really actually talk about the grammar and the syntax of English. That would be something interesting to study. He was very eager to introduce kind of cutting-edge science into the curriculum of the schools he taught at as well.
Stephen Johnson is my guest. His new book is called The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. It's about Joseph Priestley. How did he start to experiment with gases?
Well, he got into chemistry in a funny way. He had written a very successful book about electricity, a lot of which had chronicled the advances of his new friend Benjamin Franklin, and had been encouraged to start doing some experiments in electricity by Franklin and by others during that period, and did some important work in electricity. But a kind of a funny accident of history, of chance, he got a job as a minister at a church in Leeds, and was going to move into the official kind of minister's house, but it wasn't ready for him yet. And so he and his wife and their young child moved into kind of a temporary house that happened to be next door to a brewery. And Priestley, this is a classic Priestley story. He was just an incredibly inquisitive guy. And so he would go over to the brewery and kind of watch them with these giant vats of beer that they're making, and noticed that there were these kind of interesting gases that seemed to be coming up out of the vats. And so he asked the proprietors of the brewery whether it would be possible if he could conduct some experiments into these gases that they were kind of accidentally creating by brewing beer. And I just chuckle to think what these guys must have thought when this strange minister comes over and says, you know, hey, could I set up a little lab here in your beer factory? And so he started investigating this, and one of the funny things that came out of this, actually one of the first things that really came out of his pneumatic chemistry, as they used to call it, is that he invented soda water. He noticed that if you poured regular water back and forth over the carbon dioxide that was coming out of the vats of beer, that if you drank that water, you would have this kind of delightful fizzy quality that was reminiscent of some mineral waters that people had discovered and in the Alps and places like that.
And he called that his happiest discovery.
His happiest discovery. And what's great about Priestley is that he never made a dime off of anything that he did. He gave away. He discovered this amazing thing that would subsequently sweep the planet. And just think of the amount of money that's been made from carbonated water in one fashion or another. And he published immediately his findings, wrote to all the people about it, told them exactly how to make it. And even was briefly convinced that it would be useful in fighting scurvy, which turned out to be not the case. But never made a cent from it. But a couple of years later, a certain Johann Schweppes decided to patent his tonic water. And, we're still paying royalties on that when we buy, Schweppes tonic water. So he just liked to do things like that and liked to share his discoveries with the rest of the world.
Yeah, you definitely get the sense that he'd be a Linux guy if he were around today.
No, I think that's right, and it's a kind of a latent theme of the book, the value of open information networks that was central to Priestley's vision of the world and vision of what he was doing as a scientist and as a thinker, but truly was also central to Franklin and Jefferson. And they both wrote, Franklin has a wonderful line that he wrote in the 1750s about his electrical research and how he was sharing everything, even if he wasn't sure it was right, because it was best to publish things and get them out there because they will attract the attentions of the ingenious. And if you put out a problem, even if you haven't solved it entirely, somebody else might come along and they'll have a better solution for it. And that's exactly the open source software ethos. They have a famous slogan, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow in open source software, which basically means if you've got a problem in your software and you share it with enough people, someone will notice and figure out what's wrong with your code. And that's exactly what Priestley and Franklin and Jefferson were trying to do in their own work.
One of the places that Priestley liked to hang out with Franklin was this London coffee house. And until I read it in the book, I hadn't really thought much about this, but it was a major change that in the Enlightenment, people began drinking coffee, which was a stimulant as opposed to alcohol with every meal.
There are two ways in which coffee is important to this story. And the first is the physical space of the coffee house, in that what happened with Franklin and Priestley actually met in a coffee house, and they had this little club called the Club of Honest Whigs, who would get together every 2 weeks and hang out at the London Coffee House, which was right across the street from St. Paul's Cathedral, and they would just talk for hours and hours and hours. And what was important about the group there, and was important about a lot of different coffee house culture during this period is that people from different backgrounds would come together and have these interesting kind of cross-disciplinary conversations. So they would talk about religion, and they would talk about politics, and they would talk about electricity, and they would talk about chemistry. And it was a great kind of intellectual melting pot. And then you had this kind of public space where people would come together and share these ideas across these kind of intellectual boundaries. So that was crucial to the story. And crucial to the Enlightenment in many ways. A lot of important things came out of coffee house culture. The whole insurance industry was kind of invented at a place called Lloyd's Coffee House in London, which became Lloyd's of London. But the other part of it, as you mentioned, is just that the fact that they were drinking coffee. Up until that century, really, the dominant kind of daily beverage for both, you know, kind of working class and elites in England at the time was alcohol, for good reason, because the water really wasn't safe to drink, and it was better for you to wake up in the morning and have beer for breakfast than it was to try and drink some water that was going to cause you to get sick. And so you effectively had, up until the emergence of coffee and of tea, you had an entire society that was largely drunk all day long. and so you imagine just the productivity that happens when you go from starting to drink booze at 9 a.m. to waking up and drinking a couple cups of coffee in the morning. I think we'd all be a lot more productive and sharp with that kind of change. And in a sense, that's what happened to the society as a whole. And so in some real way, I think the Enlightenment is related to the shift in the drugs that people were taking from alcohol to caffeine, basically.
What kinds of records did they keep of the conversations they had at those coffee houses?
Well, it's a good question. I think for the most part, you see those conversations kind of echoing in the subsequent correspondence that happens after the events. In my research, I didn't find a lot of actual kind of minutes being taken of those meetings. But there's one of the great things about writing this book is that so much of the correspondence from that period survives. So much of it, in fact, is available online on the internet, searchable. I mean, everything Franklin ever wrote that survives in the record is online in various places. A lot of Priestley's letters are available as well. And so what you'll see is, Priestley meets Franklin for the first time with the Honest Whigs in the London Coffee House, and then 2 weeks later he sends a letter back to Richard Price, one of them, saying, that was like a beautiful dream. Thank you so much. And, I keep thinking of all the things we talked about, and I'm doing some experiments, and here's what I've done since we last talked. And so in a weird way, you see the kind of the echo of what they talked about in the coffee house, but the actual conversation is a little harder to see.
We'll talk more after a break that's coming up about some of the scientific discoveries that Priestley made, but it really is extraordinary to notice the fact that there was no siloing back then. No one said, well, you're a theologian, therefore you have no cause to talk about science, or you're a politician, so you have nothing to say about religion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I hope that's one of the lessons, one of the things that I think is important in our own context, particularly as a kind of a political moral of the book, is particularly when you think about politics and science, there are so many issues today that are so central to our society and to the problems that we face that can't be properly understood without some basic understanding of science. And Priestley was just great about kind of fusing those things, and I hope that that's a lesson that we can kind of carry on in the present day.
Stephen Johnson is my guest this hour. His new book is called The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. After the break, we will talk about what Priestley discovered about oxygen and plant respiration.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen Johnson is my guest. His newest book is called The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. If you want to join us in our discussion of Joseph Priestley, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. What was, Stephen, the generally accepted thinking before Priestley's work about the composition of air?
Well, the first thing, you know, we have to remember when we look back at this period is that it took quite a long time for people to even think that there was something to study as regards to air. I mean, if you just look around you, the world is filled with lots of objects that look interesting to study. That tree over there, and the cloud in the sky, and your body, and the rock that you might see. But the invisible kind of space between all of those things doesn't actually look like something you would want to study. There's nothing there. There's no there on some basic level. And so for a long time, people really didn't spend a lot of time kind of applying themselves to the study of air. And then one of the first things that happened is that because of these air pumps that people developed where they could kind of suck air out of a vessel, they were able to prove that a vacuum did exist, and that you could create a vacuum where there was no air, even though it looked exactly the same as something filled with air. And unusual things would happen in a vacuum. You wouldn't be able to light a candle, for instance, and bells wouldn't ring and things like that. And so suddenly it was clear there was some substance there that we couldn't see, but that was different from air, was different from non-air, and so there was something to study in the first place. And then in the kind of middle part of the 18th century, there was some interesting work that started to prove that the air was probably a mixture of different gases, that it wasn't just kind of one unified element, that it was probably a couple of different things, but no one was really clear on what it was. And so that was kind of the landscape that Priestley had inherited, and so he started to get interested in this problem after he discovered carbon dioxide, I mean the power of soda water. And the first thing that he did that I think is really important and that he doesn't get enough credit for is that he was really the first person to realize that plants were creating oxygen. He didn't have the name oxygen yet. They didn't really fully understand oxygen, but he was the first person to realize that plants were creating air that was breathable by humans and other life forms. And he did this in a really ingenious experiment. So people had known for a long time that if you took a mouse, say, and put it in a kind of sealed vessel, over time, basically the mouse would consume all the air in the vessel and would relatively quickly die. And in fact, Priestley apparently was doing experiments about this when he was 11. He would trap spiders in little glasses and kind of watch them die, which is a slightly sadistic thing to do when you're 11, but he was a little proto-scientist even at that age.
I think today we'd send him to therapy if we
That's right.
caught him doing
it. We should encourage our kids to trap animals in small vessels. And so Priestley had known this, and he'd done some experiments with it. But then he had this idea. He said, well, you know, I wonder how long it will take a plant to die in a controlled sealed vessel like this. And so he took a little mint plant from his garden. Almost all of his experiments were basically done in a, you know, kind of a laundry sink with things that he stole from his wife's kitchen and that he would get from the backyard. He was this classic kind of tinkerer. And so he put this, he isolated this little plant in this little glass, basically, and kind of waited for a couple of weeks for it to die, and it didn't die. And so, in fact, it seemed to be as healthy as ever. And so he started to wonder about that. And so the real breakthrough he had was he decided to take that plant and burn all the air out of the vessel. So he had this kind of elaborate contraption where he could use a little lens to focus the sun on a little kind of wick inside the glass with the plant. And then he lit this candle inside with the plant in this sealed vessel, and the flame kind of eventually flickered out, meaning all of the air had been burned out of the space. And it was precisely the kind of environment that would instantly kill a mouse, basically, put the mouse into convulsions because there was nothing to breathe. And he let the plant sit there for 2 weeks. And when he went back to it, he found not only that the plant was still alive, but in fact, when he went to try and light a candle, the candle lit again. It was burning. It somehow was capable of burning, even though it shouldn't have been capable of burning because all the air had been burned out of it 2 weeks ago. And so he started to think, wait, maybe the plant is actually creating this oxygen, this breathable air. And one of the the first people he wrote to about this experiment was Benjamin Franklin. And it was Franklin who really, we think, first suggested to Priestley that this was a broader phenomenon. This was not just about a tiny little planet in a glass, but maybe this pointed to something much bigger. And he said, this sounds like a rational system. We know that there has to be some way for the air to be kind of repurified all around the planet. And so it's logical probably that, the plants do us this service. And he even took it a step further, even to the kind of environmental side of things. He said, I hope news of this will discourage people from this recent trend of chopping down trees near where people live, because allegedly the air from trees is unwholesome. and he said, in America, we've got lots of trees where we live, and everybody's very healthy in America and stuff like that. And so right there was this beginning of this insight about a much larger kind of planetary system. And the truth is, the only reason we have as much oxygen as we have in the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere is about 20% oxygen. If it weren't for the plants, it would be less than 1%. It's not the natural state of the Earth. It's something that's been, in a sense, artificially engineered by these wonderful photosynthetic organisms that populate the planet. And so I think that breakthrough really, in some ways, is one of the founding events in the kind of ecosystems view of the world, that we're all connected, and that our life here is dependent on other life forms, and that there's a balance that's been created by all these interactions between these different life forms, and that we need to be responsive. Just as Franklin was saying, we need to be careful about chopping down too many trees where we live. We need to understand that system and learn how to engage with it and protect it as human beings.
Well, it makes sense that it really was a game changer for Priestley to suddenly understand that this essential element that we have to live isn't just there no matter what happens. It requires this system and the way the planet works and plants are creating this oxygen. Did that directly affect his theological views, or are those two things? I mean, how much of a connection can you really draw between those two elements of his life?
Well, it's a really good question. And there's been a bunch of scholarship on this. I think he was convinced that he had very unusual, for his time, and maybe even for our time, he had unusual religious views. He was a very devout Christian who believed that almost the entire kind of contemporary structure of Christianity and the church was kind of a distortion of Christ's original vision of the world. And he believed that if you went back to the original kind of teachings of Christ, there was great wisdom there, and that one should kind of structure one's life and values around those teachings. But he thought that subsequent priests and religious scholars had added a lot of, in a sense, supernatural stuff and kind of magic to the story of Christ. And in fact, one had to get rid of all that stuff. So he wrote a number of books about kind of getting back to the original roots of Christ's vision for the world. And part of what he believed was, he believed that the way that you understood the kind of the majesty of God and God's will on earth was through this process of this growing enlightened understanding of the world, that one was able to see the world with increased clarity thanks to the advances of science, was one of the great examples of God's will on earth. So he didn't believe that Jesus was God's son, and he didn't believe in a Holy Ghost. He believed that God's will on earth was being shown to us through this increase in kind of clarity and understanding about the kind of the shape and the nature of the world. And so that was the way that he built this kind of delicate balancing act between kind of faith and science. And it was, interestingly, it was really that had just an enormous impact on Jefferson. Jefferson ultimately said that Priestley had the single biggest impact on his religious views, and that Priestley, in some sense, kept Jefferson a Christian. So it was a very interesting solution to a complicated problem that both men really faced at the time.
On the other hand, that solution made him what you call the Salman Rushdie of Georgian England. People wanted him dead.
Yeah, it was two things. He for someone who was as controversial as he was, he apparently had this enormously upbeat and cheery and optimistic and friendly demeanor and sensibility, and he seemed to be incapable of fully recognizing how controversial his ideas were. So he would just kind of say, well, I'm going to share this with the world, because if I just say it in a nice, clear way and make my points clearly. Everyone will understand and come around. And so he would say these, you know, at the time, incredibly scandalous things about the church or about the American Revolution, which he supported, and about the French Revolution, which he supported, that a lot of more traditional forces in Georgian England did not take too kindly to. And he delivered a speech in the 1780s that became known as the Gunpowder Sermon, where he talked about laying the gunpowder grain by grain under the Church of England, basically. And that did not go over well as well.
they assumed he wanted the monarchy dead, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people thought. I think he thought that there was ultimately going to be this movement towards democratic rule. He was not a militant radical by any means. He thought that there was this kind of natural progression towards kind of democratic structures and kind of scientific progress and kind of the demystification of the world. But he was not, you know, he was called a regicide by his enemies, but I don't think he was, completely adamant about it at the time.
So he packs up his wife, and they were not a young couple at the time, and they head for the newly minted United States.
Yeah, literally an angry mob burned his house down in the Birmingham riots, and really were out to kill him. They ended up burning about 20 houses down in the kind of Birmingham area. It's one of the great stories of mob violence in the history of England. And he stayed around for about another year, and then he decided that, you know, there was that he just was not going to ever feel safe again in England. And so he decided to go to America. And in a way, he inaugurated one of the great traditions of the American experience, which was that he was really the first great scientific dissident exile to find his way to America. So there's a long lineage of folks who kind of have followed in that tradition. And he arrived and was greeted as kind of as a hero. And he breakfasted with Washington, had tea with Washington several times, and saw a lot of John Adams, spent a lot of time with John Adams in those early years. And there was a kind of an interesting battle when he first arrived about where he would settle. And you know, some people were saying, well, you have to stay in New York. And Adams kept saying, no, you have to go to Boston. Boston is where all the intellectual people were. And then eventually Jefferson started to say, no, you need to move to Monticello. This is much fun. The climate is so much better down here. And it was a little bit of a battle of where the kind of intellectual seat of the country was going to be that hadn't been totally decided at that point. But ultimately he settled in rural Pennsylvania, thinking he was going to build a kind of utopian colony out there that never really came to fruition.
How did he get crosswise with John Adams? Crosswise with John Adams.
It's an interesting story. He had met Adams in England the decade before when Adams was over there as ambassador, and they'd had a very strong friendship, and Adams had written him a letter of, had actually compared him to Socrates when the mob attacked his house, and had been a big supporter of him, and sat in the first row when Priestley started giving some sermons in Philadelphia. They had a strange conversation over breakfast one day where Priestley started to kind of ramble about kind of the apocalypse and things that he'd read in Revelation and how they impacted his vision of the French Revolution. And apparently, as Priestley got older, he got a little bit more apocalyptic more obsessed with Revelation in kind of an interesting way, which he never seemed to write about, but he apparently talked about. And
it seems to have dominated his vision for a while of everything.
Yeah, in those last years, it seems to have become, and it's a strange conflict with everything else that he wrote. For someone who was so much about empiricism and science to then talk about, the visions of Revelation in that context is interesting. But so it threw Adams a little bit, but the big problem was that once Adams was elected president and Jefferson became his vice president, the kind of emergence of the first real political parties in this country, and the split between Adams and Jefferson over really the relationship to France, Priestley ended up kind of siding with Jefferson, and he started writing from rural Pennsylvania. Started writing some pamphlets that were critical of the Adams administration, and he had a colleague out there, Thomas Cooper, who wrote even slightly more incendiary things about Adams. And in fact, he ended up becoming one of the major targets of the Alien and Sedition Acts. So that's another kind of Zelig-like moment where he shows up at this huge crisis in the American experience, and there is Priestley right at the center. And there's a this is a very important point because, of course, alien sedition is, you know, a formative moment in the history of the country and our whole sense of the Adams-Jefferson friendship and falling out and Adams' presidency really revolves around it. And Priestley was probably the most prominent person who was on the hit list. And they, in fact, did arrest Thomas Cooper, Priestley's colleague out there. But and Adams had been advised that they should try to deport Priestley for being so critical of the administration. And it was such an important turning point in the country's history because it was right then where we were trying to decide how are we going to treat our intellectual dissidents. When somebody of great stature and great prominence is critical of the current administration, what do we do to them? And it was just it was a genuinely open question. It had not yet been kind of decided. And at that point, actually, crucially, Adams blinked and decided that Priestley would not was not worthy of being prosecuted or being deported. And so Priestley dodged a bullet with that one. But it was a really crucial turning point in the country's history.
Were they still communicating with each other at all?
Apparently Adams, they were doing it a little bit indirectly, and Adams passed a message on to Priestley through Priestley's son, saying, in effect, tone it down a little bit. I'll protect you, but you really need to stop writing these pamphlets because I can only protect you for so long, and there are a lot of people who don't understand you who are giving me a lot of pressure. And so there was kind of this indirect communication, but they had really, their friendship had effectively ended at that point.
Stephen Johnson is my guest. His new book is called The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. After the break, we will talk about the role Joseph Priestley played in the rejoining of the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Stephen Johnson. His newest book is called The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. How did Priestley's ideas play into the correspondence between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson?
Cool story. So Priestley, he dies in 1804, when Jefferson gets inaugurated in 1801, one of the first things he does is he writes this quite famous letter to Priestley. It's a beautiful letter. As I've been starting to do readings supporting the book, I've decided to just read from this letter rather than read from my own book because Jefferson's prose is so much better than mine. And Jefferson writes Priestley this letter as president that says, effectively, I apologize for the last 4 years. I apologize for the actions of the administration he was vice president of. I apologize for the Alien and Sedition Acts and the threat that was posed to you. And in general, the kind of backwards-looking attitude of the Adams years. And he basically says to Priestley, you are one of the great minds of our time, and in a sense says, you and I understand that this country and our values are about looking forward, and that, science is so crucial to our understanding of the world, and we're not about the education of our ancestors, but we're about the future and all these things. So he writes this kind of glowing letter to Priestley, and he says, it gives me great honor as president to welcome you to this country, and to, you know, offer you the protection of its laws and all that stuff. So it's a wonderful letter. So Priestley forwards it to his friend, the Reverend Lindsay in London, who had co-founded the Unitarian Church there with him many years before. And Lindsay reads his letter, and then many years pass. Priestley dies. Adams and Jefferson don't speak to each other for an immensely long time. And then in about 1812, they start this conversation again. Hold on one second. Let me just get a little drink here.
Sure.
So they start this conversation that turns into the famous Adams-Jefferson letters, but in its initial, the first few volleys that they start having back and forth, it's very kind of folksy and familiar, but not particularly intellectually rich. They're basically chatting about how old they are, how many great-grandchildren they have, how they've outlived almost all the signatories of the Declaration and all this stuff. And they're kind of dancing around the fact that they've had this extraordinary falling out and they've lived through these extraordinary times. And then a book is published in London, and it's a book of the correspondence of Reverend Lindsay that happens to include this letter from Jefferson to Priestley that had been in Lindsay's archive. And that book somehow travels across the Atlantic and gets into the hands of John Adams in Quincy, Massachusetts, who reads this letter in which basically Jefferson is talking all this trash about him and insulting him and the administration and saying to Priestley, oh, you and I really understand things, whereas Adams, that guy was completely backwards and all that kind of stuff. And Adams, as we all know, was a very combustible fellow. And
he was thin-skinned, too. He didn't like criticism.
He was thin-skinned and, you know, was always feeling like he was slighted in various different ways. And so this was the worst possible thing he could have read. And so he fires off this letter to Jefferson saying, in effect, you know, what is going on here? And he said, you know, are you familiar with this letter? And he picks out the passage where Jefferson accuses them of being anti-science. And Jefferson says all these different things about Adams that are quite critical about alien and sedition and various other things. But the first thing that Adams says is, you know, I demand proof of anything that I said anywhere as president that was anti-science, that was opposed to the innovations of science. I've never said anything like that, and I demand proof that I ever said it. And so he sends off this letter to Jefferson. And then, of course, you know, there's like this 2 or 3 week lag as the letter has to go down to Monticello by a coach. And so Adams can't just sit around there and wait for the response. And so he ends up firing off 6 letters. And each one of them picks out a little passage in this correspondence with Priestley and, in a sense, kind of riffs on it for a page or so. And so then finally Jefferson writes this beautiful note back that kind of says, oh, my friend, you know, that was a long time ago, and the passions were running very hot at that point. But it is true that you did push things quite a bit with the alien sedition stuff, and, you know, my party really suffered for it and all this kind of stuff. And it's there that the great conversation between Adams and Jefferson really starts. And that's the point at which they actually start, you know, talking about what the revolution meant, what this great new experiment in political system really meant. And they talk about science, and they talk about the question of why society has not advanced at the same rate that scientific development had over the preceding century and a half, all these issues that were kind of central then. And they talk about Priestley's view of religion. Adams talks about Priestley's apocalyptic visions and that breakfast that we discussed earlier. And so in this funny way, Priestley becomes, even though he's been dead for, you know, 8 years, Priestley becomes this this crucial kind of connecting point between these two men. And really, without that letter, it's unclear that the correspondence would have evolved into the extraordinary thing that it did evolve. And so even you know, 8 years after his death, he was showing up right at the center of the American experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Addison in Arlington. Hey, Addison.
Hi, this is Addison.
Hi.
Just a quick question about Priestley and his sort of worldview and the formation of it. What do you think was more influential, his theological sort of perspective or the scientific advancements of the day? Like, which one do you think influenced the other more?
That's an excellent question. I think that if you think about influences as kind of where your initial sensibility comes from, the kind of the initial formative years. He really didn't have much of a scientific background. He got interested in science, you know, kind of as a hobby in his 20s and got serious about it in his 30s. So, but he was raised in a dissenting religious family and was from the beginning, in a sense, an outsider in the society, and had developed a very complicated and very nuanced relationship to the church at an early age. And so I would probably say that, particularly in his formative years, that the religious sensibility was more important simply because he didn't have that background. It was very hard to be taught science as a 16-year-old in England at that point. It just wasn't part of the standard curricula of most schools. And so he was much more focused on religion at that point in his life.
He did have some, despite all of the advances that he made, he had some really odd scientific beliefs that he held on to long after sort of everyone else had acknowledged that they were wrong. He believed in phlogiston. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, well, it's funny we haven't even mentioned this. The thing that he is most famous for, actually, is, and that's, you know, in the first line of all the biographies of him, is that he was allegedly the guy who isolated or discovered oxygen for the first time. Not plant respiration, as we discussed, but the actual gas itself. And it's a funny story because he was neither the first, nor did he exactly get it right when he did it. So there was a guy, Scheele, who had kind of done it first. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that Priestley actually isolated oxygen before. He just didn't realize that he'd done it. Just from his lab notes, you can kind of tell that he probably generated the gas, and it was actually there. He just didn't realize what had happened. But basically, he did manage to kind of publish his findings first. But he messed it up in the sense that there was this belief in phlogiston that was this idea that there was something in matter, in things that would burn, that there was some kind of fundamental element that made them capable of burning. And when they burned, that element would be kind of released into the air. And what's actually happening when things burn is almost the opposite. In a sense, there's this process of oxidation where oxygen molecules that are combusting are kind of fusing with the thing that is burning. And one of the first clues that that's what's happening was that people got very good at measuring the weight of things, and they noticed that things that had burned were actually heavier than things that had not burned, or their state before they burned. And so it became clear that actually something was coming from the air into the substance, not the reverse. But Priestley just never got around that idea, and so when he discovered this very combustible air, this pure oxygen, he called it dephlogisticated air, and which is slightly less of a catchy title and a little harder to say. And so actually it was the French chemist Lavoisier who several years later kind of refined Priestley's experiment, was much better at kind of working with scales and doing very precise measurements, and ended up having a more kind of cohesive theory of how this gas worked. And he was the one who actually named it oxygen, and that's where we get the name today.
Why are there no amateur scientists today?
In some ways, you can see this book as kind of a celebration of amateurs and dabblers and people working in the way that Priestley did and that Franklin did. And I think one way of looking at our society today is that there's a little bit of a renaissance of that, in the sense of that the Internet has made it possible for amateurs to share their wisdom about things in lots of different ways. You look at something like Wikipedia. We talked about open source before, where people who have local expertise, but they're not necessarily in a particular field, or they don't have credentials in a traditional way, but they do have useful knowledge, and they're able to share their ideas. And so some of those enlightenment values are kind of flourishing now again, thanks to the Internet. On the other hand, the truth is it's much harder to, discover new fundamental gases in your home kitchen laboratory than it was, back in Priestley's day.
All the easy ones have been done.
Yeah, and that's a sign of progress. I mean, the fact that we have made such progress in science makes it, necessary that you have to specialize and you have to spend 6 years in grad school to be able to make important great breakthroughs. You have to spend 20 years just to see over the shoulders of the folks who've come before you. Whereas in Priestley's time, there was just a whole world of phenomena that had not yet had the scientific method applied to it. I mean, the whole idea of doing a scientific experiment where you have a kind of controlled space and a series of elements and you do a series of kind of transformative actions on them, and you make a prediction about how they're going to behave, and you see your results, and you adjust your hypotheses. That whole process was really a novel thing. It hadn't been around that much, and so there was all this stuff that you could apply those tools to and make really fundamental discoveries about the world. And that's how Priestley was able to do it in so many different disciplines without having any real training, in a sense, because the soil was so shallow.
And I know one thing that you feel very strongly about is that today's politicians need to understand science probably to a far greater extent than most of them do.
Yeah, I mean, the book starts with, I think this is a political book with a political message for our time, but I also didn't want it to feel too partisan or feel too polemical. But it has a short little intro which quotes an unnamed presidential candidate, which was actually Mike Huckabee, which I'll tell you.
we could have Googled that anyway.
That's right. Who, in a CNN debate early in the campaign last year, it said, was asked about his belief in, or lack thereof, in evolution. And he said this very striking thing, which is a classic Huckabee kind of line, in that it was very funny. But he said, you know, I think it's funny that you should even be asking me that question in this context, because, you know, I'm running for president. I'm not asking to write an eighth grade science textbook. And it struck me as just a really extraordinary, very telling thing to say, because you would never, for instance, say, for that joke to work, you have to assume that the job description of the presidency and understanding basic tenets of science are so unrelated to each other that it's kind of laughable. And the joke would never work if he said, I can't believe you're asking me about, you know, foreign policy. I'm not asking to write an international affairs textbook. That wouldn't make any sense. If you knew, he'd be booed off the stage, right? But somehow that's still a kind of permissible thing to say in the context of science. And yet when you look at the, you know, the number of issues, you know, starting with our energy issues and our environmental issues and our stem cell issues and our computer science issues and the amazing number of things that have changed because of the internet, to try and build a comprehensive and an informed political worldview in this day and age without some, you know, fundamental understanding of these issues from a scientific perspective is really irresponsible, I think. And it's not that you have to be a scientist. I'm not trained as a scientist. But I love and I feel immensely intellectually engaged by going and reading about this stuff and learning about it and connecting all these different fields to each other. And I would hope that we would have that sensibility in our political leaders. And a big point of this book is when you look at the founders through the lens of Priestley's life, you realize that they really had that value system, that science was a huge part of their worldview. And so to not take that position, I think on some level is not just anti-intellectual, it's un-American.
Stephen Johnson's newest book is called The Invention of Air, a story of science, faith, revolution, and the birth of America. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
I had a great time, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.